Interview with Laura Unger, November 7th, 2005, at J.P. Morgan, Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Okay.
I want to start with some background. Something interesting in your resume is a B.A. in rhetoric.
Yeah, everybody thinks that's interesting.
Do you think it's not interesting?
No, I do. It was very interesting.
What did you get out of that that affected the way you do things?
Well, rhetoric is both a study and a discipline. And in terms of study, it basically consists of dissecting how people present arguments and how you would present yourself and make your point in an argument. So you break it down to ethos, pathos, and logos, which ethos is how you appear to people. Pathos is their emotional appeal, and logos is logic. And so you use those three components, both as a means of communicating and a way of understanding communications. And so we applied that in the major of rhetoric, or the study of rhetoric, in a variety of different ways, including the rhetoric of Plato, the rhetoric of evil, the rhetoric of religion, the rhetoric of fiction. So it's a very interesting study, not only of the ancient philosophers and how they used rhetoric and how it impacted our society, but then also how it teaches you to think and approach problem solving, conveying thoughts and ideas and that kind of thing in everyday life. And also the sort of logic component of it, I think, was a natural segue for me to then go on to law school. A lot of rhetoric majors were what people would consider to be pre-law. Mm-hmm. So rather than be in the humanities and literature or English or something like that, rhetoric was a very natural fit for someone who's interested in pursuing that area of study in the future, which I knew I was at the time I went to college.
So you were pre-law, for sure?
Yes.
Securities law?
Well, no, not right off the bat, but when I graduated college, I came back to New York, which is where I'm from, and I worked for my dad's business for a year because he was hoping that I would take that over. Mm-hmm. And it was a brokerage business, but it was real estate brokerage in Manhattan, and it was rather large at the time.
What business was it?
It was real estate brokerage. So it was called Pogue Simone, Pogue Simone. And there were three offices, and they had a very high-level clientele, so it was a lot of fun. It was very interesting. But I also knew that I wanted to continue what my original passion was, which was the law, so I applied to law school. Went to New York Law School, and actually, I should back up, because before I actually made that final decision about law school, I considered a joint MBA-JD program, because I knew I really did, I loved business, but I wanted to be a lawyer. So I figured anyone could be a business person with a law degree, and you can't be a lawyer with a business degree. And I really wasn't all that interested in doing both, so I went on to pursue my JD at New York Law School, and within, I guess, my first semester, I took corporations, which I found very fascinating. And then because I was at a law school in New York, we had a lot of practitioners in the securities area come as adjunct professors. So I remember having a couple of lawyers who were at Wachtell Lipton come. Of course, that was the premier M&A takeover, you know, firm. And that was very hot in the late 80s, which was when I was in law school. And so I decided that was going to be my discipline and the perfect blend of business and law. And it was.
Takeovers in particular?
You know, at that time, well, M&A, no. M&A was fascinating and hot when I was starting law school. By the time I left, it had already sort of dwindled, and I quickly found out that securities law lawyers were not in hot demand right out of law school. In fact, most firms were looking for seasoned securities lawyers. So instead, I, after having an entire file cabinet full of rejection letters, which I wish I had saved, I decided to pursue the government. And so at that time, I was living in New York, so I interviewed at the New York office of the SEC. And I got a job there within 3 days of my interview and went very well. Carmen Lawrence, Regina Mishlevitz, Robert Blackburn, and Jason Gettinger. And I think there was one other sort of lower level assistant director, but I can't remember who it was at this point. But I remembered all of them because Regina had gone to law school with my uncle. So she recused herself from any final decision making. But we caught up a little bit on my uncle. And so because I had done so well in the corporate and securities law classes at law school, my grades were really, really high in those areas. And, you know, it was a perfect natural fit. After about, I'd say, 6 months there, I took over some old cases, as most junior lawyers do at the SEC, and then, as most junior lawyers also do, looked in the paper for something new and exciting and found the Business Week insider trading case, which ended up involving the printers, McGraw-Hill, and that was the case that probably catapulted my fame in the enforcement division. So I took on that case and spent a good six months or so really focused on that case, the California part of it, and then one of my colleagues took over the Connecticut part of it.
Did you end up going to California?
Spending a lot of time in California, yes. Yes.
Tell me a bit about that case. You found this
Yes. It was the classic, well, it's funny because this still exists, and knowing my audience is the SEC Historical Society, but it was that classic tug. I was in one of the regional offices in New York, and Washington also wanted the case. And Richard Breeden was the chairman at the time. And I remember there being a discussion and a debate, and they agreed to let New York have it. So the pressure was sort of on to perform well, both for myself professionally and for the New York office to show headquarters, which is what we called Washington, that the regions could do just as well, if not better. So I remember we got the formal order, I'd say within 24 hours. I wrote up the memo real quickly. It was hand-delivered among, you know, the commission. And we got the subpoena authority, and basically I got on the train with Ira Spindler, one of the investigators, and they presented documents at the testimony. And one witness in particular, Brian Callahan, who was the, I think he was he Prudential? I think he was the Prudential broker. There was one, I can remember his name, but I can't remember his firm. I'm pretty sure it was Prudential, where he was the tipper, basically. He was paying the printer $150 for an advance copy of the Inside Wall Street column of Business Week. And I took his testimony. He brought in a huge box of documents, knowing that a fairly junior lawyer was taking his testimony, probably. But Ira Spindler was such an ace that he, as we conducted the testimony, sat through and analyzed the documents and just passed them over to me. It was a fairly magical testimony situation. I know the transcript has been well used in the trials and that kind of thing, so it was very fun.
And then did you go on to the Senate Banking Committee pretty shortly after?
No, then I transferred to the Washington office of the SEC. So after about a year and a half in New York, I moved over to headquarters, thinking that it was somewhat of a step up to be in the center of it, and that I would maybe no longer have to fight as hard for my cases, and found that it was, in fact, the center of activity. It's a little more bureaucratic than New York, and not quite as exciting in some respects and very exciting in other respects, and the part where it was very exciting was having the commission being in the same building as the commission itself, i.e. the commissioners.
Right, just being there? Or
just being there so that as a staff attorney in enforcement, I could attend and sit in the way back where hopefully nobody could see me, the weekly enforcement meetings, and really watch how the commission set the enforcement policy. And I thought that was probably one of the most exciting things about being in Washington. And the commissioners at that time included Commissioner Grunfest and Commissioner Fleischman. Again, Richard Breeden was the chairman. And it was a very intellectually challenging environment in terms of the colleagues being very much expert and very intellectual and practical in their discussions about the federal securities laws and the nuances of the cases and the nuances of the policy and the direction the commission was taking in approving the cases. And I just found that to be so completely energizing and exciting and cutting edge that, for me, that was one of the most memorable things about being in Washington.
Did you have people who were dominating the commission in those discussions?
I think the three I mentioned, because I can't off the top of my head even remember. I think Mary might have been a commissioner at that time. And then who the fifth was? Commissioner Roberts, maybe?
Yeah, she was on there with Roberts.
But I think this was before he came on.
And of course, there have been a lot of times when there weren't.
I know, there wasn't a full five. Absolutely.
Okay.
But to observe Commissioner Fleischman, Grunfest, and the chairman sparring intellectually was quite a sight.
So they really did spar?
Oh, of course. That's well known. Now you have it documented.
Any notable cases in Washington?
In Washington for me?
Yeah.
It was a lot more competitive for, I think, the high-level cases. I had some interesting cases. Nothing that really stands out the way the insider trading case stood out. The other thing that was, because Washington is where policy is made, I felt that my division directors and associate directors were also spent more time with their staff talking about legal developments and, you know, sort of integrating that into the enforcement agenda, how we manage the cases. And I remember particularly when Bruce Heiler was my associate director, he was very, very good about that. And the first day, I don't know if I should be saying this on tape, but one of the first weeks I was at the commission in Washington, he called a 4:30 staff meeting on Friday afternoon. I thought, I cannot believe that. Gosh, these guys are really hardcore. I showed up in his office, and of course, there was beer. It was a cocktail party, which they did every Friday. And it was a lot of fun. And we actually did conduct business. But it was a very relaxed atmosphere, and we'd talk about the week, and we'd talk about any significant court cases or what, you know, failure or success the commission, you know, rather the staff had with the commission that week in the enforcement meeting. And so it was a very productive way and a fun way to end the week.
A morale building.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who was the director of enforcement at that point?
I was there at the end of Gary Lynch, when there was a long period of no one, and the beginning of Bill McLucas. And he was actually the acting head of the New York office when I was there. But he was going back and forth from Washington to New York.
What made you take the jump over to the Senate Bank
Committee? Although I never thought I would want to leave the commission because it was the most exciting place in the world to work, I was probably a little disenchanted with my caseload and the types of cases I was getting, and I wanted something more challenging. Someone had told me that Senator D'Amato was looking for banking and securities legislative assistant, they're called. And I hate to admit it, but at that time, even coming from New York, I had no idea who Senator D'Amato was. I had no idea what the banking committee did or what a legislative aide would do. So I went up and I talked to some of the people. I found out how hard it is to get your call returned by anyone on Capitol Hill. And they were very interested in having me come on as a legislative assistant, but didn't have the budget to pay, by then, you know, a fairly experienced lawyer with a good background in the federal securities laws. So I think I was probably making, you know, some big salary of $30,000 at the SEC, or $35,000, and they just didn't have the budget to pay more than probably $20,000, if you want to put it in numbers. So eventually, we worked it out so that the SEC would lend me to the Senate Banking Committee for a period of 6 months. And I recall being called down to Richard's office, Chairman Breeden, and he had a good relationship with Senator D'Amato. And so the two of them spoke and reached an agreement. And I think, obviously, it was a what you would call a win-win, because the SEC would have someone who was knowledgeable about the federal securities laws and the agency helping the senator from New York with policy and the budget and, you know, other issues that would be relevant to the SEC. And the senator would get someone who was of a higher caliber, if you will, or more experienced than they would otherwise get. So I remember Richard calling me to his office and saying, you know, you're going to go work on Capitol Hill. You got to be careful. I don't think he said a cesspool, but I definitely think he could sense that I did not have a huge context or perspective on what it would be like to work on the Hill. Now, I never saw the cesspool side of it, or whatever his exact terminology was, but he was very protective, and he was very considerate and thoughtful, and excited about the opportunity for me, which he was kind enough to facilitate. So I remember appreciating that quite a bit. And the senator couldn't have treated me any nicer. He treated me like gold. And it was a fantastic experience. You know, at the time I originally went up, the first 6 months of the 3 6-month periods, I ended up being a congressional fellow. Senator D'Amato was the, you know, third senior member of the committee, and the Republicans were in the minority. By the time the 3 6-month periods were up, I think he wasn't quite chairman, but he was poised. And then, of course, Senator Garn retired, and Senator Hines was killed in a plane crash, and all of a sudden, Senator D'Amato was the chairman of the committee. So it was quite an interesting time.
Did you help a good deal in the Private Securities Litigation Act?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
That was interesting, because the whole idea of the PSLRA had been something Congress had been speaking about for some time. The champions of that were Senator Domenici and Senator Dodd. Domenici from New Mexico and Dodd from Connecticut. Of course, Dodd is a Democrat and Domenici is a Republican. For their own reasons, and I don't think they had the exact same reasons, they were very concerned about this notion of these private securities litigation class actions and the drain it was having on capital formation, and the fact that they were really, in most cases, completely frivolous and distracting business from business, especially Silicon Valley, even though neither of them are from California. So there was discussions about this for some time, and then when the case came out in 92, was it? 91 or 92? That, and now I can't even remember the name of the case. I have to think about this. Because I didn't prepare for talking about PSLRA. No, that's okay. I should know it off the top of my head. But the case came down that basically imposed a statutory statute of limitations, I guess, on bringing these private or securities class action lawsuits. And for a period of time, am I blending these two cases? I can't remember exactly. But in any case, there was a pivotal case that I'll probably remember by the end of the interview that impacted and made much more compelling the need for this legislation. LAMP. The LAMP case. And it did impose a statutory statute of limitations. It was 1 year from discovery and 3 years from commission of the act for bringing private securities litigation reform acts. The case wasn't clear about whether this applied to the SEC. So the SEC had an interest in making sure that the statute of limitations did not apply to the agency. And, of course, the... that just doesn't sound right. I feel like I'm confusing something. But in any case, and then, of course, the plaintiff's bar wanted to extend that statute of limitations, which they thought they could do congressionally. So there were a lot of interests in seeing a piece of legislation pass. Whether I'm getting the underlying facts right or not, clearly the time was right to do something. And Senator D'Amato, of course, had a strong interest in the legislation. He's also close friends with both of the co-sponsors of the legislation. And for us, it was a lot of brokering in terms of finding ways to balance the interests of the business community with the interests of the plaintiff community, and not precluding plaintiffs from being able to bring real private securities, where there was a valid claim, private securities litigation reform, class actions. So it was a very emotional piece of legislation, because obviously it involves people's rights. But there were two main controversial parts of it, two pieces of it. One was the English rule, or loser pays. And I remember there was a long period of time where Senator Dodd was pretty adamant, maybe it was both of Dodd and Domenici, about loser pays, that would be the only thing that would truly keep people from bringing frivolous class actions. However, the other side of that is the chilling effect that would have on people who were, you know, justifiably bringing these cases. That was one. What we ended up settling with is proportionate liability. And the other, I guess, was the Rule 11 sanction? I don't know. I'm going to have to think about it. But there were two very controversial pieces of it. Maybe it was the extending the statute of limitations, that the quid pro quo was going to be extending it from 1-3 to 2-5, 2 years from discovery with a 5-year cap. And that was just something that the business community did not want to do. But we ended up working out a bill that, while modest, I think has been effective. And then, of course, what happened after the PSLRA 95 was that a lot of these cases started getting brought in state courts to circumvent the federal law. So in 96 or 7, right in the middle of Arthur Levitt's second confirmation hearing, right about that, contemporaneous with that, came the piece of legislation that then applied it to state court also, that preemptive legislation.
What about you talked about the business community and the shareholder or the plaintiff's community. What about the regulatory community? What was the consensus from the SEC about this new legislation?
They were very much against loser pays. They very much wanted to have the longer statute of limitations because, as you know, the SEC can't bring every case, and the private plaintiff's bar has always been an adjunct in some cases to the SEC's enforcement agenda. And I think while they wanted to restore order to the system, they were more more on the side of don't cut off any people's rights. But they were very helpful also in some regards with the Rule 11, with reckless versus negligent, you know, definitions, with duty to update. There were a lot of nuances to the law that had to be considered, whether whether it was an opportunity to instill or impose a standard for what the duty to update should be of public companies. We ended up remaining neutral on that issue, but it was after a lot of study and discussion as to whether we should impose a federal standard and then say there was no duty to update or how we should approach it. So there were a lot of very intellectual conversations and a lot of very emotional conversations about the whole issue. And again, there was somewhat of a dearth of factual evidence. A lot of it was intuitive because most of the cases were being settled. And unfortunately, of course, they'd never succeed at this now. The accountants were driving this legislation in large part. Mm-hmm. So the firms had a keen interest because they were always the deepest pockets. While there are hundreds and hundreds of law firms, you know, back then there were only 8 accounting firms. So, of course, they bore the brunt of any private securities class action lawsuit because they always, those lawsuits always named the lawyers, the auditors, and the bankers. And the auditors seem to be the ones paying the most often.
Okay. Well, getting into your time with the SEC, I was interested in that it appears there was talk about nominating you for the commission in 95.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I had two sort of swipes at it. That's true. I first got the call in about 95. I think it was in this, I'm trying to remember the timeline, but it was in the midst of the end of PSLRA. Apparently, at or about the time that my name was to be presented publicly, and then I was to be publicly nominated by the Clinton administration, President Clinton, was about the time that the Senate had, or rather the Senate and House had, were wrapping up the conference on PSLRA, which, by the way, Chairman Cox played a big role in also. It's how I first met Chairman Cox, now Chairman Cox. So they were wrapping up that, and I guess the president was pretty certain he was going to veto the PSLRA. Didn't want to nominate as an SEC commissioner someone who had worked on legislation that he was prepared to veto. And it, in fact, was, I believe, one of the only or the only bill he vetoed during his entire 2 terms. So we then had the veto override, which we were successful at, obviously. And that was all around Christmas of that year. So that took us into 96. He wanted a respectable cooling-off period, but lo and behold, in about April, the Senate Banking Committee started the Whitewater hearings. So that just didn't seem to be a great time to nominate one of Senator D'Amato's aides either. So then it sort of quieted it down. And then, quite honestly, my recollection is after a year of just sort of me fortunately being in the position where it didn't matter, where I could continue my daily responsibilities without being recused or, you know, having any awkward moments, having a pending presidential nomination, I think Senator Graham expressed an interest in pushing a few candidates. And it was at that time that the White House decided to pick up my nomination again. So I had to have a second background check. I had to resubmit all my papers. And that was the time that they had chosen Paul Carey to be my counterweight, as if you will. So Paul and I, of course, had a very a close working relationship anyway, because he was the White House legislative liaison, and he was good friends with Senator D'Amato. But we said we had a symbiotic relationship in that he got my name out of the White House, and I got his name out of the Senate. So that's pretty much how it happened.
So it was a package deal.
It was a package deal, as so many things are in Washington.
Yeah, that
was a few times. Yes. Actually, that was somewhat of the beginning of the trend. They initially had thought that I was going to be part of the Hunt-Johnson, the Hunt-Johnson confirmation, but they couldn't push it that fast. And then Paul and I became a package.
But those two were still in there.
Yes. They were the commission that Paul and I served on with Arthur as the chairman.
Tell me a little bit about that, what you found when you came in. All of a sudden, you know, you've seen it from the enforcement point of view and the staff. Did the institution look different when you came in as a commissioner?
Well, I had already worked in the Washington office.
Right.
We were in the same building. And I had never really put down the SEC policy issues or legislative issues. Put down as in put aside, put to rest, because for the entire time I was on Capitol Hill, which ended up being 7 years, I was Senator D'Amato's legislative person and then eventually became counsel to the Senate Banking Committee for securities issues. So while I was not at the SEC, I was never far from securities or SEC-related issues. So I had, interestingly enough, worked on PSLRA, NSMIA, Government Securities Reform Act, PSLRA 2, and I'm thinking if maybe that's it, actually. Those were the big pieces of legislation, and then other amendments, and FDICIA. I would now, including with FDICIA and Glass-Steagall, which I had worked on the reform, but I don't think I was there when it actually occurred. But, of course, I had been through the dress rehearsal enough times. I was on the receiving end of all of those rules and all of that policy when I got to the commission. And many of the studies that we had ordered in NSMIA, which was passed in 96, by the time I got there in 97, they were just implementing or just finishing. So it was actually a really interesting transition to be at the agency then responsible for implementing a lot of what I, as a legislative counsel, you know, had ordered.
So you knew what the intent was in a lot of this.
Yes, stuff, yes. I knew what the intent was. I knew the agency certainly really well from a staff perspective. I knew it from a leadership chairman perspective. But I didn't really know it from a commissioner perspective, although I had gone to lunch with and socialized and had a business relationship in some cases or working relationship with some of the commission over the years. Nothing fully prepares you for walking in the door and sitting at your desk on day one at an agency that you knew a lot about but weren't necessarily one of the policymakers at.
What is the commissioner perspective?
The commission in perspective. Well, it's not as if this was something I hadn't been thinking about on and off for 2 years. So I had plenty of time to plan my agenda. I had gotten a lot of advice. It's interesting when you, being a very visible public servant, obviously working on Capitol Hill at a fairly high level for a very senior, the chairman, from New York, I knew a lot of people, the heads of the firms, people on the Hill, the heads of all the, of course, all the senior lobbyists for all of the financial firms, and a lot of the SEC alums. I was just amazed at the groundswell of support and people who called and said, let's go to lunch and let me talk to you about what it's like to be a commissioner. So I did have that. I had a lot of, probably most of the former commissioners who were still around and, had time to sit down with me, reach out and, give me advice. And it was a very helpful exercise, both socially and intellectually, to sort of prepare myself for what I would be facing and to give me advice both on in a proactive way and in a what to avoid kind of way. I remember one commissioner, Commissioner Fleischman, telling me that it's very easy to be overtaken by the SEC's enforcement agenda and that you could really spend your entire tenure as a commissioner, and a couple of commissioners said this, just keeping up with an agenda that you never set. Keeping up with the chairman's wishes, keeping up with the staff's wishes, the rulemakings, the enforcement agenda. And you could leave at the end of your 4 years without ever saying, here's what I did, here's what I thought, here's what, I wanted to make a mark in, what I wanted to pursue, what I found interesting, or anything else. So that you needed to actually really, really work at being proactive in that way, or it would never happen.
That's an interesting piece of information. Mm-hmm. It appears as if you did that.
Yes, I took that to heart.
But there's one thing I want to touch on before we get into that is at this point you're sort of taking over the woman's chair.
The woman's chair.
Yeah.
Was it obvious they were looking?
Was it really enough that there was still this sense that, oh, it's sort of, we need a woman's chair and this is...
Absolutely, positively, totally and completely. There was a frantic search for a Republican woman, a woman who was knowledgeable but not terribly controversial, who would be probably kind to the staff and get along well with Capitol Hill. there were a handful of names. I don't know why the other candidates weren't chosen. I assume I was chosen because I fit all of those qualifications, despite having worked for Senator D'Amato. It was the good thing about me and the bad thing about me. And, you know, he was a champion, but not a vocal champion, knowing that it wasn't necessarily my best asset, and it wasn't my worst asset. So,
did you ever get people who sort of acted on the assumption, well, she's just here because she fit the demographic?
No. I always felt that I was treated with respect. Although there were times when I'd walk in a meeting and I could tell by the people I was meeting with that they were surprised that I was young, as young as I was.
An even bigger factor.
Yes.
Well, some of the things you did.
Young, and I was pregnant within a month of taking on the job. So young and visibly pregnant after a short time of being in office. That's right. But you know what? I worked right up to the day I had the baby. And in fact, that's probably the most energetic period of my life ever is when I'm having a baby.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it can make meetings and things awkward, though, I guess.
Well, as much as I and other, you know, female professionals would like to think that we've come a long way, there is clearly still a long way to go, particularly in the financial world. I deeply respect all of my colleagues that I work with now, that I've worked with before. I enjoy them. I don't ever feel slighted. I feel they take great pleasure and joy in working with someone young with a sense of humor who's somewhat knowledgeable or perhaps very knowledgeable. But there's still a long way to go. And I don't notice it anymore, but I'm still the only woman at the table or in the room a lot. And that's okay. It's better than not having any women in the room. But certainly to be 37 and with child and a policymaker probably threw them off a little bit.
Yeah.
That's good for them.
Right. Well, one of the first things, you talked about how enforcement could set the agenda. One of the first things you did was look at it.
Yes.
Was that your initiative?
Or? No. That was Arthur's initiative.
Okay.
Some would say he was trying to throw me off from my other initiative, which was technology. But I was happy to do it, actually. I thought it was a very, you know, people are always cynical about other people's motivations, but I thought the enforcement review was actually a great way to get started as a commissioner. And certainly the enforcement division did not embrace the notion of a top-to-bottom review. It could have been awkward for Bill, who was leaving, and, you know, Dick Walker, who was just coming on. I'm sure Bill was sensitive to perhaps being criticized without knowing what the outcome would be. But he also knew me very well and knew that I would be fair and balanced. And in implementation, it was a perfect time. It was the ideal time to build a record, and then pass the information on to an incoming director. It's much easier to affect change with a new person.
And you actually had a hiatus there.
Yes, absolutely. But when Dick came on board, Dick Walker came on board, I had finished the review and sat down with him and went through the findings in my review. It was also a fun group of people that I had assembled in the building to conduct the enforcement review. But as with anywhere, oftentimes you would ask a question and be met with blank stares, and because we always did it that way. But a lot of what I focused on, I actually started the, I guess contemporaneous with meeting with the staff, I met with the outside industry, with all the former general counsels. I met with a lot of the commissioners. I met with a lot of practitioners. I met with academics. And then, of course, I had this whole sort of inside working group. So I think I got a fairly broad perspective. And, you know, obviously former general counsels included Harvey Pitt and Jim Doty and all the rest of the names that would be very familiar to you. And a lot of the issues are the same issues that we see today. It's a very big challenge to maintain an appropriate balance in the enforcement division between vigorous pursuit and, you know, overzealous prosecution. It's not easy, and I know, having been one of the people in that division, how hard it can be and how you can get caught up in a case, in a fact pattern, in a gut reaction to knowing that someone's guilty, even if you don't have a shred of evidence.
That was the finding that was really screaming out of this?
No, that was what I think sent the when things get skewed, that's the public perception. The finding in this, what I developed as an agenda, ranged from the fact that everybody was getting rated the highest in their reviews, that there was no self-selection among the staff, that the process for opening an investigation wasn't rigorous enough, and we didn't close enough cases, that the enforcement program set by the division director didn't necessarily coincide with what the commission wanted to set as policy, that the messages weren't always clear, that they weren't always presented contemporaneous with rulemaking, that a lot of times enforcement took liberties with making policy, either in something that was more appropriate for rulemaking or something that the commission should have had a more of an opportunity to opine on. The timing of the cases themselves, the fact that they're often investigated, settled, and, you know, all the papers are drawn by the time the commission first sees them. That kind of thing. Getting ahead of the ball. Investigations taking too long. People not knowing when an investigation's over. A resource issue. So, really, it ran the gamut of every single piece of the enforcement division. Every rock was turned over. The administrative process. You know, everything.
What's the solution to that? More structure?
Well, some of the recommendations you've seen included sweeps. You know, that kind of thing. More real-time enforcement, which Harvey, I don't know whether it was from my enforcement review or his original input colored my recommendation, where it exactly came from, but certainly the real-time enforcement notion. The fact, one of the examples I pointed to was the bank sales of mutual funds. By the time the SEC got around to bringing that case, which was Sovereign Bank or whatever it was at that time, there were already rules out prohibiting the conduct that we were bringing a case about. It meant nothing. It was pathetic, really. And so the notion of being on top of things and timely and getting the message out better and faster, and not investigating every last defendant, the nth defendant, as people call it. Bring the case, you know, sometimes bring the nth defendant, but not always. If you've got to make the point, get in there, make the point, and move on, you know, or bifurcate the case, that kind of stuff. How to make it more efficient, more wieldy, the fact that the demands for the enforcement chief's time, that's when I had the idea of bringing back the deputy, which was Steve Cutler, that kind of thing, really doing a better job with what we had. Now, of course, they have more now, so maybe it's time to take another look at it.
Well, that's an interesting question. You were coming at sort of the tail end of the Clinton administration. There had been a freeze on the FTC as far as funding was concerned. Was the effect of that noticeable on the institution?
You know, it was a freeze, yes and no. Congress has always been very concerned because of the extensive enforcement authority that the SEC has of letting the agency get too big. There were a couple of members of Congress who had not personally experienced but had close friends who personally experienced an SEC enforcement action. And I know they warned me and admonished me. See, I got admonished going up to the Hill and coming back about the enforcement division and that it's run amok and that we really need to, I think they called it kangaroo court, and that we really need to be mindful of the process. So that's not the impression of your agency that you want your appropriators to have, and these were observations coming from the appropriators. So while there was an idea to have the SEC be self-funded, like the FDIC, I think, is self-funded, that never took off. And so, not to get, you know, sidetracked today about how the SEC gets appropriated, but part of the problem is we were in the we are in the Commerce State Justice budget. The SEC brings in fees through registration and trading transactional fees and public offering fees, registration fees. These fees go into that pot of money. The 6B fees and the Section 30 fees are statutorily set, but every year the appropriators raise those fees. So the contrast between what the agency was getting for a budget and what it was bringing in terms of revenue was just startling. It was 3 to 4 times. It brought in revenue 3 to 4 times what they were getting in their budget, which then prompted this whole move about a tax on capital formation, which the first tax was the frivolous lawsuits. The second tax was this budget, the statutory budget. So eventually what happened was the fees, there was a bill that I worked on that was passed to bring down the fees over a period of time so that the agency would become self-funded. In a sense, the appropriators would set the budget every year, but the fees were set in this piece of legislation, as was the budget, kind of, so that excess fees did not go into the general pot, and that it imposed a lot of discipline on the appropriators for the other programs that were the recipients of the SEC fee money. But that was a way to sort of grow the agency and have the funds that it generated go directly towards funding that growth. And then, of course, the corporate scandals hit, and all the time that we had been saying, myself in particular, that we need closer to $1 billion than $500 million, then, of course, everybody wanted to make sure that they didn't have the fingers pointed at them, at that them being Congress and the administration, I believe, in short shrifting the commission's budget.
And, of course, fines are getting bigger all the time, too.
Right, but the fines don't go into the budget. That goes into the Treasury. Because there's the danger that you would, you know, become even more of a kangaroo court. Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about technology. You already said that this was your agenda item,
yes,
so to speak, and that's clear. What influenced that decision?
It's the whole, first of all, I found technology very fascinating, personally. I'm not a gadget person. I still have a hard time figuring out how to use my BlackBerry. But the notion of how it would revolutionize the way we regulate the markets, the we being the SEC, the fact that it touched on everything the SEC did, both in providing information to investors, it colored the way they accessed information and made investment decisions. It changed the way they ran their own accounts, and it also changed the way the markets worked themselves. And so it was this huge sea change in how we, the agency, could leverage this free flow of information and this, you know, these faster moving markets into really doing a hell of a job, you know, in getting information out to investors and having trading be more efficient and effective and transparency. Really, the whole notion of transparency would be greatly facilitated and revolutionized by technology. I thought this was something that the agency really needed to take a close look at and figure out how we could make capital formation more efficient, how we could make trading more efficient, and how we can make investors a little bit more self-reliant in terms of how they make investment decisions and, you know, not necessarily relying so much on their brokers.
Was this a matter, you know, the regulators are always keeping up with the innovation that's coming from the
Right. This was an attempt to get ahead.
Okay. Well, talk a little bit about the steps. There's the online brokerage.
Well, so what, if anything, should the commission be looking at in terms of the current regulatory regime that provided obstacles to harnessing the powers of technology to improve the way investors invest and the way the markets function? And much as I would have loved to look at the entire universe of that proposition, I realized that I could not and ever finish a report. So I instead took online brokerage as a subset of the bigger picture, and looked at what was really vexing practitioners and investors, including, and the commission, including suitability, looking forward, if there was the sort of Barnes and Nobles, is that the, who started that, actually? I don't remember if it was them. One of the booksellers, the whole notion of you like this book, then you'd also like these books.
Yeah, Amazon.com.
Amazon. Thank you. I knew it wasn't Barnes and Noble. The whole mass customization or customization of one idea where you would take information about people's habits by, you know, the cookies they left at various websites and develop a profile and ship them out investment ideas. I was pretty convinced that was, you know, the model of the future, or a possible model of the future. So what kind of regulatory challenges did that entail? The whole idea of the online trading systems failing a substantial amount of times where they'd be down, systems problems, you know, what did they have to do? What were their obligations in terms of having backup? Investor education, what did the commission have to be doing about warning investors or making sure they understood how online trading worked? Execution, how did it impact best execution and the broker's obligation? And obviously that's something we're still talking about. So those kinds of ideas that were fairly traditional, well-accepted notions, not all of them clearly articulated in regulations, but the basic principles of investing.
At the heart of this, is it that there's no longer the face-to-face between the broker and the customer?
The disintermediation of the industry. Now, remember, this was coupled with the completely, dare I say, erratic, was it, marketplace, where people were sort of crazed, and anybody could invest in anything and make money, basically. So a lot of the basic principles of investing had been tossed by the wayside. At the same time, at the same time, the actual mechanics of investing changed, where people were empowered by information. No longer did an investor have to wait for a broker to send a research report or get a stock quote. You know, all of this information was available on websites. And so people took that information and, or felt that they could take that information and make their own investment decisions. So it was a confluence of a number of events that really made the markets a little crazy.
Did they complain to the SEC when things didn't work out?
Only when things didn't work out.
Of course.
So the complaints really were more about the mechanics during the vibrant period. Once February of 2000 hit, the complaints shifted dramatically to suitability, churning, that kind of, you know, it was my broker's fault, or the system was down, I couldn't get on, I tried to cancel the trade a million times, that kind of thing. And that always happens. And that's the interesting thing about regulation generally. When markets are good, nobody wants to impose layers of regulation to make it harder to make money or to raise money. But when things are bad, that's when all the regulation takes, you know, hits, with like Sarbanes-Oxley, right at the very time that companies are being hit by a million other things. So they're struggling to make money as it is. It's tough. It's very tough to maintain investor confidence during the hard times without layering on the regulation.
This issue of suitability, it seems that that really dominated for a while, and probably in this down period,
yes.
I guess. Did you ultimately come up with a policy? Was there a way to make rules having to do with suitability?
There was a way to provide some guidance through interpretation, and what we ended up doing after going round and round with the staff, some of whom embraced the idea of giving more guidance on suitability and some of whom were completely dead set against it. And granted, it was my report but you didn't want something that was completely uncredible. You wanted something that was constructive. So we ended up coming up with a set of hypotheticals and providing guidance on specific hypotheticals, you know, about whether there was a recommendation made, because really the whole notion of suitability is triggered on a recommendation. And the notion of when you have, when a recommendation has been made, and I'm saying it in the passive tense because that's what it is in the area of technology, there's a whole bunch more potential for there to be much more subtle recommendations. And that's what really drove the discussion on suitability.
So these hypotheticals, were these circulated to the industry?
These were included in the actual report itself.
I guess I'm wondering if they had some statutory standing or something like that, and then people would look at those and use those guidelines.
Well, yeah, people did, and it represented not just what I thought, because it was my report, but what was credible to the agency. And so people clearly thought that the agency wasn't going to back away from anything that was in the report.
You had an opportunity to really take a snapshot of this emerging industry, I guess, in 1998, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
What did you see? Was it wildly different from company to company, website to website?
I wouldn't say wildly different. People had the same goals in mind. I think, of course, the online brokerage firms wanted to stay as far away from having any suitability obligation imposed on them than as they could, because their business model couldn't sustain that potential cost. And the potential cost goes back to our conversation on frivolous litigation, right? If they have a suitability obligation, they got to do a whole lot more. Yet, they were looking for different ways to distinguish themselves from online broker to online broker. Because you have execution, you can compete based on execution, and you could say, well, I'm only $6.95, I'm $7.95, I'm $8.95. But that really only takes you so far. You have to have the quality of execution. You have to have people believe your systems are going to be there for you. You have to believe there are going to be people answering your call if the system's not working. You have to believe in basically the integrity of the organization, that they're going to be there tomorrow. And a lot of where these firms were making money was in margin. They were making margin loans to customers. And I think that was something that we at the commission talked about, that I had a revelation about in my visits to the online brokerage firms. They were charging a lot of money for margin. And there was huge exposure there because of the leverage, obviously, both for the firm and the customer. That was a little bit frightening. And then they clearly treated different customers differently in terms of, you know, what they could access information-wise. And the IPO allocations. I talked to a little bit about that with each of the firms when I was visiting, but I didn't include that in my report. And the IPO allocations were made based on the biggest customers. Pure and simple. No big surprise. Nobody tried to hide that ball. Our biggest customers get first crack at the IPOs. And, you know, at some point in time, the commission found that surprising, but nobody ever made any bones about that, so that was kind of interesting also.
Sort of carrying on a venerable tradition.
Well, so when you say what was different about the firms, there was some difference in execution quality, but it was probably mostly the margin loans and the IPOs and that kind of thing where they were able to attract and retain customers. And service.
Did the aircraft carrier concept have anything to do with this idea of changing?
There was a piece of the aircraft carrier that we tried to take out of the aircraft carrier that I think, my memory is not so clear on this because it was a small piece of what I was doing, but there was a technology component of it that when the aircraft carrier was going on, we tried to get separated out to be made into a different rulemaking that was really much more technologically oriented because the aircraft carrier was was dying of its own weight. And I think we did end up providing guidance on it, but not, you know, in pieces. And that was more about the road shows, what's writing, what's in writing, and what's not, what's permissible, that kind of thing, the more capital formation, capital raising side of technology.
Rather than secondary trading.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk, I want to hit on regulation fair disclosure.
Okay, I need to take a little break.
Sure.
What a perfect time. do you want to?
Yes, right. Well, it goes right into digital.
Wow.
We email or FTP it to the transcriber.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very nice. We just quit using cassette tapes a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Technology, you know. Information.
See, I told you.
I'm interested in where the impetus for regulation and fair disclosure came from.
Arthur.
What was he responding to?
He perceived an unfair advantage in that analysts had material non-public information, although I'm not sure he would have put it that way, but that analysts had information that investors didn't. The analysts were taking advantage of having this information and passing the information on to firm clients who were trading on that information.
And was he correct in that?
You know, he probably was correct about that. I didn't disagree with the notion of the problem he identified. Didn't really know the order of magnitude, nor could we point to any attempt to bring an enforcement case for that type of behavior. And although the case law, current case law to date, would not allow you to necessarily, well, it would have, let me back up. I thought the SEC or the commission should have brought the difficult case and lost it before it resorted to a rule that really went to communications and not trading. If it's about trading, bring the case about trading. Don't write a rule about communications. There's no parity of information. It's clearly recognized in the federal securities laws and in many case dicta. And I think that's what FD seeks to accomplish, and I think it's unworkable. I think most companies hate it, and I think it's dramatically reduced the amount of information that the marketplace receives. And I say that with great certainty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a few years perspective.
Well, and, you know, serving on public company boards, I see it. I see how it's implemented. I see what it does. I see that everything is scripted. If that's what you want, then that's what you got.
Weren't things scripted before, though?
Yes, things were scripted as a beginning point, but not a beginning, middle, and ending point, and that's what it is now. And scripts are fairly benign.
Did the SEC put this out as a concept release or something like that beforehand?
Yes.
Get feedback?
Yes.
What was the feedback like?
The feedback was mostly from the press, who was completely out of sorts that they weren't included originally in the definition of who FD applied to. It would have encompassed the press or the reporting public, I guess. I don't know what you would call them necessarily. But that was later refined to be just financial professionals. And again, the SEC has read a duty into other relationships, into a husband and wife relationship, into certain, you know, doctor-patient relationships where it doesn't necessarily exist. So if it was about something that's clearly wrong, which would be an analyst passing information on to firm clients who traded, I think he could have found a creative way to bring that case. The SEC has done that many times.
Your point is it's sort of going around the back door.
With a much more onerous approach to curing the problem. You don't have to trade to violate Reg FD.
Mm-hmm. Was this one of the few times that the commission was split when you were sitting on it?
Yes. And actually, Ike Hunt was very vocal against it, but he ended up voting for it.
Who was?
Ike Hunt, Commissioner Hunt. That's my recollection. He might tell you differently.
was it the same grounds?
Mm-hmm. And I think that the staff failed to make the case that we really needed it. It didn't point to a whole lot of instances of trading.
But you know that this came from Arthur Levitt?
Yes.
And did he detail somebody on the staff to make this case and put this whole thing together for the commission?
You know what? It was based on intuition, and there's nothing wrong with intuition, but it should be the starting point, not the ending point, for the basis or the foundation of a rule. Call me old-fashioned. I'm not saying that lots of rules aren't made that way. I'm sure they are. But this was one I found particularly onerous and not compelling.
Was this pretty close to the end of Arthur Levitt's tenure?
Yes. Yes. But he completely respected and understood that I disagreed, and he was fine with that.
But
of course he did. And it was somewhat contemporaneous with the auditor independence hearings, which that was in 01 where we finally passed that rule. And FD, I think, I did a 6-month review of that when I was acting chairman. So maybe that was in May? So it must have been one of the last things that Arthur did. I can't remember, but it must have been the fall of 01, or early or late fall.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the auditor independence.
Mm-hmm.
Was the FCC ahead of the curve on this one?
I'm on page 504 of the Enron book, Conspiracy of Fools, and it does sound like Arthur was pretty ahead on this one. I wasn't as focused on what he was doing with those speeches and those issues, finding the accounting issues incredibly dull, quite honestly. and I must have been off doing something different. I can't remember at the time. But when I read, and I read it in context now, I have to give him, a pat on the back for that.
Do you remember the discussions in the commission?
Oh, yeah.
What was the tenor of those? Was it consensus that here's the problem, here's how we fix it?
There was consensus on the problem. There was not consensus on the solution. But I take my hat off again to Arthur for undertaking a very brutal way to sort of lay the foundation and establish what the issues were and put some color and texture to the issue. And that was the hearings, the public hearings that the commission conducted in Washington and New York about auditor independence. And all of the firms participated, many practitioners, public companies. It was a very thoughtful cross-section of the industry. And we sat through, I would say at least 100, I remember counting it up at one point, 105 or 110 witnesses. And I think 5 to 7 days of hearings, a lot of documents. I sat through almost all of it, probably 95% of it, for which Arthur was very grateful. In which, in exchange, he was very gracious about me voting against FD. but I thought it was also a very intellectually stimulating conversation. Not every point of that 95% that I attended, but it was curious to me to find that audits became a lost leader in the industry. That was something I really focused on during my questions. I found that mind-boggling.
In the auditing industry.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We, the auditors have an SEC, you could say, God-given mandate that, all public companies have to have audited financial statements by an independent auditor. Doesn't get much better than that for job creation. And for them to not take that seriously and for it to become the minor point of their business or the corollary to their consulting business was a very dangerous proposition. And clearly, it was more dangerous at some firms than others. So I think I'd give him, again, kudos for taking on that issue. It was not an easy issue.
Did you get a sense that there was a public following for what the SEC was doing at this point?
I think people were very grateful that the SEC was raising the issue. I'm very curious to see how it would end up. Because the having seen the accounting lobbying force during the course of PSLRA, I knew how compelling and wide-ranging their support was and how difficult a battle it would be if we couldn't come up with something that they felt they could live with. Now, everybody spun off their business and was, you know, during the course of the time that we had the hearings, a couple of them had or were thinking about it anyway. So it was really one or two of the firms who were putting up a huge fight.
And this is, was this before Enron even?
Yeah. Not so much before, though. About a year before.
And you became acting chair?
Yes. February of 02.
And
01. 02?
Yeah,
01.
What did you see your role as being?
Well, I know most people said I was a gatekeeper, but I saw it as more than a gatekeeper, more than a steward, but not, it was not a time for me to develop a huge rulemaking agenda or policy setting agenda. Certainly all of the agency had been told not to do that by President Bush in the first instance of his new administration. But I saw it as a chance to have a somewhat limited agenda to make good on what the commission needed to be doing. People couldn't think that because there was an acting chairman and because the president said no new rulemaking that there was no one home, right? So we still had to be involved and in the mix. And I needed to keep the morale going. There was my number one item on my agenda, which I knew I could accomplish and which people had made some progress on, Arthur had made some progress on, was pay parity for the SEC staff. And I knew, having been an SEC staffer and having worked on the Hill and still having, you know, a lot of relationships on the Hill, that I was probably the best person that will ever sit in a commission seat to make that case. And so I was relentless in going to all of the key members of Congress to push for it. And we did eventually get it. So I thought that was a very productive way to spend my time and to really seize the opportunity, you know, to do that, to make a difference. And they promised me a statue. I haven't seen it yet. I think they've long forgotten that I was even the one who closed that deal, because Harvey came right. The White House signed that piece of legislation right as Harvey came in the door, and I didn't even make it to the signing ceremony. So, that aside, I also made good on the promise of the commission to do the FD 6-month look back in New York. Did we do it in New York and Washington? I can't remember. And we did a report on that. And then just I had hoped to do some public thinking by the commission, which was myself and Icahn at the time, and the staff, about global markets, which is something I think the commission really needed to spend some time on. And that just wasn't something that he was comfortable with. And so that was really pretty much it, other than keeping the division director's feet to the fire, kind of, and developing 30, 60, 90, 120-day plans and that kind of thing.
The Reg FD look back.
Mm-hmm.
Any surprises?
You know, I was very glad I did it. People were happy that I followed up and that we actually did what we said we would do. Any surprises? No. I didn't think so, actually. I knew it was a bad rule. So I think that was sort of the general gist. There were people who supported it. I didn't have an unbalanced panel or anything. I didn't try to skew it to support my position on it. It was a really completely neutral hearing as far as that went. It was supposed to be informational, but no, I don't recall anything terribly surprising. I think stands out in my mind.
Then Harvey Pitt comes in.
Yes.
Right? Did you get more than three people on the commission?
No, and in fact, I would have left when Harvey came, as much as I was looking forward to working with Harvey, because I've known and respected him for a long time. I felt that leaving as acting chairman was leaving on an uptick. And to go back to being a commissioner and just, you know, sort of resuming that position wasn't really necessary. I had spent, you know, my 4 years there. My term had expired that June. It was August. It would have been a very perfect, graceful time to leave. The problem was that Ike Hunt's term was about, his term had already expired, but his carryover period, his statutory carryover period, was also about to expire in October when Congress went out. Here it was August, and if I had left, then there was no candidates in sight that were, you know, about to cross the threshold into 455th Street, so I had to stay on or leave Harvey by himself, which would have been historic. But not very nice.
he had enough troubles on.
Yes.
To deal with.
Yes.
I guess that's one of my questions. You were in there with him for a while. Is it your sense that because of everything that had happened with Enron and the accounting scandals, that there was just so much more pressure on somebody, on the chairman of the SEC? Was that part of what
his downfall?
Him in the press?
Harvey is an incredibly able lawyer, someone I used to confide in or seek input in, because I, as Congressman Schumer said, he was the Zeus of the federal securities bar. I don't think that was his best performance as when he was chairman. Where he challenged with purely intellectual issues, he probably would have had a very different outcome. Yet his political judgment clearly was lacking, and he failed to give his very excellent advice on more than one occasion. And it snowballed, and it got worse and worse, and rather than step back and say, "Ew, this isn't working, let me talk to some people who can maybe help me." He may have done that, but I wasn't one of them, and clearly you had a colleague who was experienced as a commissioner and who had worked on Capitol Hill.
Right.
I could have been a powerful ally for him, but I think it's easy to have 20/20 hindsight. It's easy for me to look on to what decisions he made and what he said and did and say, I would have done it differently, but you know, you can never say that with certainty.
Right. Well, let's talk about what you did.
But he made me look really good as acting chairman, and I thank him for that. And he remains a good friend, so it's hard to be critical of a good friend, but I'm obviously just very honest and straightforward in my answers, always. It just was the wrong person for the wrong time.
You left the SEC without anything lined up, apparently.
Yes.
Always kind of interesting, I think.
It's the only way to do it.
Historically, it looks like people are always just,
yeah,
they got the next.
You can't be a sitting commissioner and interview. I don't see how you do that.
How did you end up with J.P. Morgan?
Actually, that was not my first job. My first job was CNBC out of the commission. And that I was approached by the then chairman and CEO, Pamela Thomas Graham. My second job was a seat on the Borland Board of Directors. And my third job was and I had a private consulting project. And my fourth job was J.P. Morgan. I had been one of the and that's right, I left this out of our conversation about acting chairman. One of the issues that I raised in a speech at Northwestern, the Ray Garrett Institute, in April of 2001 was analyst conflicts. And I testified on that a number of times as acting chairman. In fact, I testified a whole lot when I was acting chairman on the budget, on this, and on, I think, technology or something. In any case, that was my pet issue to talk about, and I had an internal task force from each of the divisions, with representation from each of the divisions about analyst conflicts, to come up with, A, a picture of what the issues really were, B, what each different division saw in those issues and whether they had any ideas about how to solve the problem, if there was one. And, you know, was I on C or D? C or D, three, to come up with some ideas, some rulemaking, a concept release, admonition to the industry generally about analyst conflicts and what they should be doing. And right about that time, the SIA came up with some best practices. And, you know, Chairman Baker had his hearings. In any event, that got the ball rolling, and there was keen interest in analyst conflicts at the press level, at the investor level, at the congressional level, at every level. It really resonated, given that particular time, given what information was coming out. So where was I going with this?
How you got to...
Oh, right. So everyone knew how passionate I was about this issue. Harvey had kind of shelved it when he came on board, and I advised him not to, and that he needed to do something. It didn't have to be a rulemaking, but it had to be a proclamation, and we needed closure on it. That ended up being very true. So in any case, the issue obviously got taken up by Elliot Spitzer, and people had thought I would be a perfect person to be one of the independent consultants. So apparently, three or four of the firms submitted my name. I interviewed with three of them.
This is the global setup.
Yeah, and the process was that each of the firms would have to pick three names for independent consultants. I think there might have been one name first, and then it ended up being three names, that they would like this individual to serve as their independent consultant, submit those names to the regulators, who then would approve or disapprove, partly based on an interview with that person. So there was it was hysterical. There was an article about me being the Belle of Wall Street because everyone had submitted my name, well, and I could only pick one. So the SEC assigned me to J.P. Morgan, and that happened in May of 2002. So that was '03.
So the SEC gave you this job.
Yes, they did, for 5 years. So I got to be, once again, on the other side of an issue that I knew a lot about and was passionate about. So,
what's the nature of this job as an independent consultant?
I procure the independent research in compliance with the global settlement. So basically, I choose independent research providers for each of J.P. Morgan's covered company universe, which includes all equities and a portion of foreign companies. That trade, you know, for which the U.S. is their primary market, and that they trade. There's a float volume test, and that's it in a nutshell. It involves obviously a lot more than that. And in fact, all of the independent consultants just submitted an annual report about the first year of the settlement's implementation. So the reporting period, is July 27th. 04 through July 26th, 05, but the report itself was due October 31st. So Spitzer's office is going to release them all publicly, and so there'll probably be some discussions and press interest in a lot of the statistics that were given.
In general, is it working?
I think it's a little too early to tell, quite honestly. The independent research provider universe coverage quality or product needs a little improvement in some cases. The firms are picking up more coverage, not less, the settling firms. It's been a huge challenge to go from roughly 700 covered companies to 1,400 covered companies with a limited dollar amount and with a limited universe of independent research providers, some of whom really have a bad product and, you know, a couple of whom have a fantastic product. Competition's not there yet. It's not as robust as it should be, as broad and robust. So.
Terrific. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that?
No. I mean, we could talk about the independent director stuff, but we don't need
sure.
to go there.
Is that something that you were deeply involved in?
No, I sit on three public company boards. Not Borland anymore.
As part of your later career.
Yes.
Yeah. Which one?
MBNA, Ambac Financial, and Computer Associates.
Oh, right.
With Walter, again, with Walter Schutz.
And again, you're sort of looking at the other side of things.
Yes.
Well,
for Computer Associates, I joined the board the month before they signed the deferred prosecution agreement, knowing that it was about to be signed.
Well, terrific.
Okay.
Mike, thank you for talking.
Sure. Thank you.